So let's welcome Stephen and Richard Payne here on the Mike Church Show on the Crusade Channel, King Size Truth, from Radio Size Speakers. Gentlemen, good morning. How are you?
Very well. So good to talk with you, Mike. And
Hi, Mike. How are you? Very good.
This is Richard. Go ahead.
And this is Stephen.
Now, you guys, this is a father-son team, correct?
You bet. Yes, we've been at it. Actually, Stephen was in Hollywood and also the Canadian industry, film industry, after film school, and really just was overwhelmed by the satanic nature, really, of the film industry. And he left it in 1991 and came back, and I had been a publisher of Catholic books and editor for 25 years at that point. And he looked at me and saw words. I looked at him and saw pictures, and we said, this must be God's an invitation for us to come together and make movies, which I had started to do early in my life, but I ended up with the book. And so that set us off.
And well, as you can tell, he's got the voice. So.
Now, well, it's good to be with you very much. And we're delighted that you like our work. And
we're great admirers of your work, Mike. You've done such a great job over the years communicating the truth to the people. Thank you for all you do.
Forget about it, but thank you. You know, I want to start off, first of all, welcoming both of you. And you're the second father-son media team that I've met in my life. So my first question is, what's it like, Dad, to work with son? And I'm the harder answer is, Stephen, what's it like putting up with your dad?
Well, we haven't killed each other yet. That's a good thing, you know. So, I mean, it's been a great blessing. I can't say how much I appreciate my dad and how I've learned to I've completely relearned all of the things that he and my mom taught me as a kid. But more so, he's taught me so much more in terms of the faith and philosophy and theology, and it's been a great blessing in my life. And I'm now newly married and with a wife and baby on the way, and it's just I wake up every day thanking God for this great collaboration that has now been 25 years and growing.
So. Wow, that's fantastic. Richard, what's it like working with is he your baby boy? Is he your oldest boy, middle boy? What is he?
He is my oldest of the five children that my late wife and I raised. And, of course, the classic tradition of the church is that the oldest son is given to the church. I didn't do that consciously, but that is what's happened, really.
I want to, let's talk a little bit about movies, but first of all, Stephen, so you went to film school, so we'll just talk about Wolf in Sheep's Clothing, so are you the cinematographer?
Yeah, I do some of the cinematography. I've shot most of our films, but in recent years, we've collaborated with more artists that came in that had a lot to contribute to the visual quality of the films. But I'm in I really oversee the creative the technical and creative development of the film and the translation of a lot of the research and writing into script format. But it's when I first started in the industry. In the mid-80s, really, I was apprenticing as far back as then, but this was a time when it was dinosaur television or 35-millimeter film, so it's a very different world than it is now. So when I left in 1991, the kind of digital revolution of that we see today was really launching then, so non-linear editing And later in 99 and 2000, we saw the birth of high definition, you know, digital technology. I had to learn all this new stuff. So it was like starting all over again in a certain way.
Well, the reason I ask is because the I'm going to put the picture, the screenshot that I made in the chat room. First of all, who is the actor in the fedora smoking a cigarette that stars in the wolf in sheep's clothing? Who is that?
He's our good friend, Jim Morlino.
And, he's Jim, awesome.
Jim is a great actor. He's one of the great actors we know, and he's a person of great faith and deep understanding of this of these problems. And we've been friends since 2009, and we've worked together time and time again since then. He was he played Father Michael J. McGivney, the servant of God for Saints Alive, which we produced in 2010, and we've worked on other things, many other things since then. But when this film came up, we knew immediately who we wanted to play Alinsky, and and talk about a dead ringer. He really knocked it right out of the park. We love Jim. He's just so great.
Well, there's a couple of things that are going on with the Jim Morlino, right?
Yes, Jim Morlino.
Okay.
Yes. And he's novice. Pictures.com.
NavisPictures.com.
NavisPictures.com.
Okay, so there's a couple things going on in the scenes that feature Jim Morlino as Saul Alinsky. One of them is, you would never think about this, but here we have a Catholic film made in a modern era, and to me, the shot that I remember most in the whole movie is this actor who stands on camera and who chain smokes. And I'm going... You're not allowed to smoke anywhere on film anymore, are you?
Well, I got a great story for that. I mean, we were trying with the digital cigarettes in the beginning when we were shooting this stuff. Of course, they just don't work the same. So Jim is a smoker, and I've been trying to get him to quit for a long time. But, you know, he said to me he had never smoked so many cigarettes in his life when he shot that scene, those scenes, and he actually had to walk out because he turned green a couple of times. So, you know.
Well, it's very convincing, though, and that's why I asked who the cinematographer was, because whoever set the shot up and then executed it, I mean, it's just brilliantly done. It looks dark. It looks foreboding. He doesn't look happy. He looks sinister.
Yeah.
You know, it looks like, okay, bad stuff's coming out of this guy.
Yeah.
So it's just very well done, guys.
Thank you very much.
Yes, Steven directed the film, of course, and that was his concept from the beginning.
So
yeah, it's a bit of a 40s noir type take on on the whole thing. So.
Well, 40s noir, and if we're talking about Alinsky, 40s noir as in Nazi noir.
Definitely, there's a little bit of a lot of those dark people. I think
he does look like, if you know, if I just showed you the film and you didn't have a voice, I'll do the voice for you. And so I step up to the camera and I look at the director and I say, "What are you looking at? If you look at me the wrong way, I have a place for you out in Auschwitz." You understand what I'm saying here?
Sounds a little bit like out of Young Frankenstein.
Yes.
Where you got Igor and Frankenstein.
Igor.
It's very convincing. And this is what, to me, separates good filmmaking from, people, God bless them for trying, but you guys actually have you actually have talent, you have skill, and there's artistry here. So, this is not your average documentary where you go like, "Oh, I could tell you made that in iMovie." No, they didn't make this in iMovie. Richard, walk me through the process of why the Saul Alinsky story, because this is not exactly going to endear you to a lot of people.
Nah. Well, actually, we were approached by Doug Keck, the president of EWTN. He had the idea to do a documentary on Alinsky because he was seeing, from his vantage point, the incredible impact across the church in America of Alinsky's work, and concerned about particularly the undermining of the church's social program, the Campaign for Human Development. But so it was his idea, and he asked us if we consider it, and we prayed about it, and thought about it and talked about it and called him back and said, sure.
That was in 2015, I think, yeah.
So then how do you go about the process, and who was the principal author or screenwriter, if you will?
I did all the basic research and the first cut of the script. And, of course, Stephen and I worked together, and he contributed to tightening up my – I tend to overwrite. He simplifies and cuts down, and we end up with something ultimately that seems to work. And off we go.
I thought I was the only one who overwrote. Well, you know, Mike, you could have told that shot in 30 seconds. No, come on, man, 7 minutes. 7 minutes, man, 7 minutes.
I had started in the industry before, after philosophical and theological studies. I was in the seminary, and Mary called me in and called me out just before ordination. And I went off to work for the National Film Board of Canada and CBC Television and Radio as a researcher and sometime writer. And so,
just before they became communists.
Yeah, the existentialism was flowing in and taking over everything. So I took off for the safe country classic books and developed the classics of Western spirituality.
Now, so let me ask you then, Richard and Stephen Payne, who are the creative geniuses behind Wolf in Sheep's Clothing and many other films that we'll talk about, you can find their movies at arcadiafilms.com. And, of course, you can find them. We have at least one of them now, Wolf in Sheep's Clothing, on our site at mikechurch.com. And we have a special deal on it today. You can purchase it today and today only. It's on sale. Talk to me for a moment here, Richard. When you started, when you said you did the research on Alinsky. Now, I got to tell you, I covered the Obama campaign. I knew all about William Ayers, Bernadine Dorn. I could tell you everything you ever wanted to know about the Annenberg Foundation and all the stuff that you uncovered. But I didn't know, I hardly know anything or knew anything about Saul Alinsky. Is that where you kind of like me? You knew all about Obama's background and you knew the name Alinsky, or did you know Alinsky before you sat down to research?
Well, I did. I had studied education at Loyola University in Chicago, even though I was raised in Canada and living in Canada. I came down there in 64 and 65. And while I was there, I got a bit involved in civil rights, some civil rights activity. And through the Norbertines, I heard about the work of Saul Alinsky.
Okay.
And so I began to kind of look into what he had done. And I talked about it with one of my spiritual mothers in the history, but Catherine Daugherty, the foundress of the lay apostolate movement, Madonna House in Canada. And she had run Friendship House in the south side of Chicago back in the 30s through 1947 when she came to Canada. And she was quite knowledgeable of Alinsky's work and concerned about implications, because she was an expatriate Russian baroness.
Wow.
From the revolution, and she was seeing, of course, the rewind of the Bolshevik revolution in America. And so that's really goes way back. So over the years, I've followed his Galinsky's projects, which were initially supported by Bishop Scheel of the Archdiocese of Chicago back in the late 30s, and with all kinds of support that Bishop Scheel arranged for Alinsky. So he was really launched out of a false reading of Catholic social principles, that people, Catholics, were trying to provide support for trade unions and out of the teachings of, especially of Leo XIII, Rerum Novarum, and so on. And this was, as the cultural Marxists do, they get inside and they subtly turn things away from God and into a kind of secular humanism and materialistic view of things. But it was the what he did was basically shift communism from economic orientation to
right.
a cultural one.
Right. Richard and Stephen Payne from Arcadia Films and the creative minds behind Wolf in Sheep's Clothing, a must-see film about Saul Alinsky, on the Dudemaker Hotline with us. We'll talk about some other films too here. So I learned this from the movie that Alinsky appeared on Firing Line with William F. Buckley. So Stephen, you don't really get to direct that, because no one can direct WFB to begin with. But yeah, you did include it very effectively in the film. Just tell me a little bit about Alinsky and William F. Buckley.
Yeah, sure. That was a great find. It is probably the best interview that we really had. And I wish that it had been 2 hours rather than just 1 hour, because I think Buckley was just getting warmed up. And of course, Alinsky in his mastery of confusion tactics really kind of danced around Buckley, which is if you watch the whole interview, which you can actually see on YouTube, you could just search it and watch the whole thing. It's actually now being stewarded by the Stanford University's
The Hoover Institution?
The Hoover Institute, right, that's right, yes. And so,
well, anything worthwhile that comes from Stanford comes from the Hoover Institution.
Yeah, that's right.
That was just my shot in the dark, okay? So.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, that we had actually in the original cut a lot more of the interview. There was some really great lines, and you know, of course, we know that Buckley had such a great gift for wit, you know, to break through these some of these strange things that he would discuss with these people. But he, you know, there was a lot more there. I wish we had actually ended up keeping in the film. But, you know, of course, directors hate to make cuts from their film.
Right.
They're running over, you know, a certain time. You're trying to scale it back to get, you know, to make sure that we don't lose the audience. But that interview was really very... very good, and it reveals a lot about. There's also a great radio interview that was done, and I'm forgetting. He's another communist friend of his from Chicago. I can't remember it off the top of my head, but we didn't include it in the film. But you can Google that as well. On the internet, it's quite revealing. He mocks Jesus, and he really had no respect for religion. You know, in a sense that he wanted to use it for his purposes.
Well, I think that William F. Buckley dragged that out of him. That's in the clip that you have in the film, right?
Yep. It's quite a. This man was really quite difficult when it. And conniving, in a sense, he knew exactly what he was doing. He had a great way of manipulating people to see his way. He would often say that in interviews. I think it was there in the Buckley interview. He would say, "You know what I'm talking about, right? You're my friend. Yeah, you know exactly. I know you know what I'm talking about. You know." So there's a familiarity with people that he would use charm to get them to kind of accept him as a friend, but. The wolf in sheep's clothing is there nonetheless.
Boy, boy, howdy. Richard and Stephen Payne, the creative minds behind Father and Son team behind Wolf in Sheep's Clothing, the movie, on the Dude Maker Hotline with us. Telephone number 844-527-8723, or also broadcasting this live on YouTube today for free for anyone that wants to watch it. And there are many people that actually are tuned in. Stephen, now you have to flesh out kind of like the biography of Alinsky. So I guess your dad probably writes this part of the narrative into the screenplay, or did you tell him, "Hey, Dad, we got to have some bio info on this guy before we get into what I want to talk to you about, which is Alinsky's infiltration of the church."
Well, again, you know, people like stories, and they want to be told stories about people, and we did want to tell his story, and that was a big thing for me. Of course, Dad, his great gift is to be able to see the theological and philosophical implications of these things. So I think we both came to the decision in the end that telling his story, but also bringing insight and also the spiritual implications to if you use these rules, what it does to you as a Catholic.
By the way, Stephen, the interview that you referred to was done by Studs Terkel.
Studs Terkel, yes.
The communist, yay.
Yeah, and the final one in Chicago was the one he did with the Playboy. And that was just a few weeks before he died.
Now, and that was a, I don't know if you intended it this way. Folks, you got to get this movie, and we're going to get into the details of why you got to watch this movie, because it'll help you understand a lot of what's going on today. But I don't know if you pondered this when you were putting together the artistic part of the death of Alinsky. Okay, so this guy is a Marxist, right? He's a materialist. Where would you want a materialist to fittingly die? Outside, right outside of a financial institution.
Yeah.
I mean, it's perfect.
And in Carmel by the Sea, you know, the sort of utopian vision of California, the, you know, westward ho the wagons.
Right, right. Now, do we know, is he making a withdrawal or a deposit?
Never found that out. Too bad.
He was probably doing both.
So that's where my mind was going. I'm like, what a great place for this guy to die. Yeah. Alone with no one to, you know, to hold his hand and say, "Do you want to convert? Do you want to convert? Do you want to confess?" Just bam, drop dead right down the sidewalk.
Right on the concrete. Yeah.
Right on the concrete. Now, let's get into the nitty gritty, gentlemen. This movie is a game changer for Catholics, and for those of you that are not Catholics, and maybe you have a hang-up about the American and Canadian version or the English-speaking version of the church, and you don't see why you ought to because it does this and that and the other. Well, one of the reasons why it doesn't do the things it should do and it does do the things that it shouldn't do is because of Saul Alinsky. And the two gentlemen that I have on the Dude Mega Hotline have made this incredible film that details this. Let's go back to the Land O'Lakes Conference, which I believe is where Alinsky, right before the Land O'Lakes Conference, Alinsky enters the scene. Is that right, Richard?
That's right. And it's the bridge by Father Egan, who was Monsignor Egan, and he was an Alinskyite. Very early on, he was introduced to Alinsky by Bishop Scheel back in the late 30s. And
probably his ended closest up friend, at, Dad.
Yeah, and his closest friend, right. And a close friend of, as Alinsky was, of Jacques Maritain.
That's right.
And the, what you have there is when that conference was seeded by the fact that Father Monsignor Egan was forced out of the Archdiocese of Chicago by Cardinal Cody, but then ended up at Notre Dame. Father Hesburgh invited him to set up shop there. And, of course, that had a profound weakening effect on the university, which we're seeing today. And that led to Hesburgh convening of that conference, which really contributed, we believe, to the secularization of Catholic universities. And leaving just a handful now of college, small, mainly liberal arts colleges, holding to the faith, in the face, and in support of St. John Paul II's his teachings on the nature of a Catholic university.
So Alinsky meets Monsignor Egan. The Land O'Lakes Conference goes on. They basically agree that Catholic universities don't need to be Catholic anymore, and Alinsky is one of the ones that helps to convince the deans and the provost and the priests and the reverend fathers that there's such a it'll be good for Catholic universities, right? This is classic
to the dialogue, the
yes.
Universal dialogue from all corners. So you open up for the devil's minions to get in and begin to monopolize the conversation and equal time, you know.
The road to Vatican II and all of its confusions coming about.
Right, and so after these reverend fathers of all these major American Catholic universities, you got Notre Dame represented there. You have Marquette, you have St. John's, you have Villanova. Name your school. They're there. Most of them side with the findings of the statement, the Land O'Lakes statement, because they all sign it. And now Alinsky has a bunch of clients, a bunch of prospective clients that have the Vatican's bank or the American, the USCC bank at his disposal. And this is where the real fun begins for the infiltration of the Catholic Church by Saul Alinsky's Marxists and those priests and others that unfortunately they're all validly ordained, but boy howdy. They had evil on their minds. Now, I think you make the point in the film, Stephen, and Richard. I guess you wrote this that look, and the priest that you keep that you interview, the older gentleman that you keep going back to, and he says
Father Mitch Pacwa. Yeah,
what was his name?
Father Mitch Pacwa.
Yeah, Mitch Pacwa. You keep going back to him, and he goes, "Look, we meant well. We meant well." And I'm going like, "I don't care what you meant, Padre." Explain, how did you find this gentleman? Let's talk about his role in the film.
Well, Father Mitch, he had quite an experience as a seminarian.
He's a Jesuit.
He's a Jesuit, mm-hmm. Yeah. Based in Chicago and working on the South Side. And he came face-to-face with Alinsky and organizing by two priests that were actually trained by Alinsky himself.
Mm.
And so Father, of course, you know, what Catholic doesn't care for the poor?
Sure, sure.
And doesn't want to feed the poor. And, Jesus asked us to do this. He commanded that we care for the poor. And so, but then, you see, this is where the evil steps in, is that the... It uses that love and that charity to twist it into some kind of social, it's almost like a social point of view that is corrupt. I mean, it's not Catholic. They use Catholic theology to try to. To manipulate people into using the basic principle of the end justifies the means to care for the poor. And that's the real backbone of Alinsky. I mean, if some people ask me, what's the basic principle of Alinsky? What if you could say it in one sentence, what could you do? Well, he uses the basic principle of the end justifies the means.
And he uses the principle of that social work done without the roots being in God and in the recognition that that of the nature of grace flowing from heaven to earth rather than just on an earthly basis. By the fruits you know them, you see that all of these projects of Alinsky, there's no fruit significantly, yet they move from place to place with this utopian promise of really cleaning up pockets of poverty, and it doesn't really happen. You go back a number of years, things are worse. You know, it's like the efforts of so much of the war on poverty, you know.
Well,
this is like a military.
The President Johnson's project,
Let me jump in here. Richard and Stephen Payne of Arcadia Films and the makers of the movie, among many others, Wolf in Sheep's Clothing. Again, available on a special deal today at MikeChurch.com/shop. Go check it out. This point was made. I just attended the Catholic Identity Conference in Weirton, West Virginia with Chris Ferrara. He gave an entire talk. Mm-hmm. You would have loved this, Stephen. Richard, you would have loved it. Chris's entire talk was on Paul VI's relationship with this, I think it was Mary Tan. Who was an Alinskyite. And then Ferrara traces and he goes, okay, let's see if we can find Paul VI quoting Alinsky. And then Ferrara makes his whole presentation on, as a matter of fact, we can. So
he met with Alinsky for a week.
And this is an incredible story.
Paul VI for a week.
Right.
In Rome. And with the philosopher Jacques Maritain, who was the kind of mediator of this event. And we don't know much about what happened. But, I mean, nonetheless, a week?
Well, Ferrara went and went through post-meeting with Alinsky writings of Paul VI. And it's pretty obvious that the Holy Father got a lot out of Saul Alinsky. Yep. Let's go back to Chicago now. So in this film, Wolf in Sheep's Clothing, Alinsky starts small in Chicago. I think it was outside a housing project with a soup kitchen or something.
Basically, meatpacking industry right at the stockyards in Centertown, Chicago, where these old Catholic neighborhoods, you know, of first generation immigrants from various parts of Europe, and
back of the yard.
Right.
It was the name of the project. Alinsky used that as the name of his very first project that began in 1938.
And now this progresses on up into the 1970s. Now, look, the easiest way to learn all this is to just get a copy of the film. But we're going to walk through another a part or two of this. Who is the bishop that ultimately brings Alinsky teaching to Notre Dame and sets up shop? You know, I have a very special devotion to the Blessed Mother. I told a story at the Catholic Identity Conference, gentlemen, about how even when I was falling away, I just came back to the church 5 years ago, 6 years ago, when I was falling away, she never abandoned me. I had Notre Dame everything, and I never realized until I did my total consecration, wait a minute, Notre Dame, Our Lady. I was never. So I am deeply offended by the fact that Our Lady was infiltrated. The university that bears her name was infiltrated by Saul Alinsky. You detailed this in the movie, and I didn't know any of this. It's an absolutely incredible story. Who wants to tackle a little bit of that?
Well, you, Dad, you knew him.
I did know Monsignor John Joseph Egan. He died in 2001, actually. He was very active in both the Industrial Areas Foundation, which was the first institution that that Alinsky founded after completing two projects in Chicago, the Back of the Yards, and then another that was really project in an Afro-American community adjacent to the University of Chicago.
Okay.
But he also was appointed as the chaplain to the marriage and family life program that emanated out of Chicago and went international, actually. And the program, led by man and wife and Egan, really initiated a lot of the principles, I would say, began the undermining of family life under the guise of renewal.
Right, right, right.
And that is really what the target is of communism, Marxism, cultural Marxism, is to destroy the family. First, a false view of sex that is no longer set in a marriage committed to a recognition that the primary purpose of sex is to give life,
right.
To bring life, and love is a natural reality that goes with that, but it's also a commitment. A total commitment of purity to avoid anything in the marriage that breaks that unity, such as adultery, and
much of that program was basically directed at Notre Dame, wasn't it? Correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, it did come to Notre Dame, but it wasn't really ever part of the university formally.
Wasn't either, wasn't he?
Yes, but he had his. It's interesting. The first time I met Father Jack was I was introduced to him by another Chicago priest. Well, actually, he called me. I was a publisher then. He had done a little. He wanted to write stories, and the first story was a story of a dog of a friend of his called, and the children of a friend of his, Nora, Maeve, and Sebby. And he wondered if I'd be interested in publishing it. This is Father. I'm just blocking on his name. He became a great novelist. I can't think of it right now.
It's okay.
But, in fact, he introduced me to Jack Egan. I had my first meeting. His office was in the library building, the Touchdown Jesus building where when the Notre Dame is playing football.
Greeley, Dad.
Yeah, Andrew Greeley.
Andrew Greeley. Okay.
Yes, and he, I sat down with Jack, and then he invited me to lunch with Father Hesburgh, and this was, 1970-71, I guess, around there. So, and I got to, he was so full of humor and fun. He was so charming, and it just was amazing to me how charm worked. I found myself going along with a lot of things that once I left the gathering, it was like suddenly I was seeing things for the first time, what had been said, and I wasn't very quick on the reaction at the time. But, as time went on, I began to see more and more that their agenda was not mine. It was not the agenda of the church, and that was the major issue.
And of course, Monsignor Egan was thrown out of the Diocese of Chicago, and so he set up shop to do all these things at Notre Dame, and he stayed there for the rest of his life. And it was a home base for him for the rest of his life for all of these projects, these Zelenskyan projects.
So it would make total sense then that one of the most infamous student, Zelensky's most infamous student of all time, Barack Hussein Obama, would be extended an invitation to speak at the commencement at Notre Dame in 2009, isn't it?
That's right, because Monsignor Egan was very close with Father Hesburgh, who was the president for many, many years. And so, there's a deep deep connection there.
People that didn't understand, like me, didn't understand a connection, watch the film Wolf in Sheep's Clothing and you will. I want to play the trailer real quick for the audience, because you guys sit back and enjoy your own work here.
Lest we forget at least an over-the-shoulder acknowledgement of the very first radical who rebelled against the establishment and did it so effectively that he at least won his own kingdom, Lucifer.
Saul Alinsky was a 20th century American radical. Today, he's best known as the father of community organizing.
The goal of Alinskyan organizing is to restructure society according to a statist model, a collectivist model, and to restructure the church to support that.
Socialists strive to bring the overthrow of all civil society.
And the last is like a gray wolf, neither black nor white, but gray in their cunning.
Who's afraid of the big bad wolf? Big bad wolf, big bad wolf. Who's afraid of the big bad wolf? La, 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 la.
All life is warfare. The end justifies almost any means. Rub raw the sores of discontent. You do what you can and clothe it in moral garments.
There is a dark force at work in the world.
Injecting poison in education. Injecting poison in the news media.
Men and women are not exchangeable parts.
Kill children, destroying families.
Blinding us to where the real danger is.
What's at stake is the entire Christian culture.
That's a, Stephen, you can produce trailers for me anytime you want, buddy.
Thank you.
That is an absolutely stellar, incredible piece of artwork there. But it's all taken from the film. So
I wanted to say something. I remembered the key links for Egan. He was involved with the founding of the Christian Family Movement, CFM, with Pat and Patty Crowley, man and wife. They were very much influenced by Monsignor Reynold Hillebrand, who was transformed seminaries in the United States, both drawing from socialism. And their source for much of that was Belgian priest, at that time Canon Joseph Cardin, but later cardinal, and founder of the Young Christian Workers and Young Christian Student Movements, which opened more and more. On one level, they're saying, well, the Catholic social teachings, but into those movements were infiltrated by Marxists.
Now, there's three things that I heard. Richard and Stephen Payne, the creative geniuses behind this film that we're talking about, Wolf in Sheep's Clothing, that you can get in our store today on a special deal, mikechurch.com/shop. Stephen, I heard the three things that I didn't know that I learned, and you explained them in great detail in the film. Three schools of Marxist socialist thought. Frankfurt, Fabian, and is it Grimsatch, Grimbaldi?
Gramsci.
This makes up the canon, if you will, of Alinskyism. And if you want to get to the political basis of it, well, there's three ways that they taught this. The amazing and sad thing that you learn about watching Wolf in Sheep's Clothing is that these three schools, if you learn, and you'll learn this in the film, if you learn what it is that they teach about socialism and how to implement it, you see this inside the Catholic Church today.
Yep.
You know, with all the controversies that we're having over this catechism and that catechism, I mean, what Pope Francis has done is this is a classic Alinskyism. I didn't know. I didn't say that. No. I'm just saying you could think like that. And it may be good to think like that. It may be an improvement to think like that. But I didn't say you had to. This is classic Alinsky, isn't it?
They also don't seem to learn from history and how these basic principles from these three schools have never really worked, ever. They've never worked.
No.
And so they failed every single time. But if you look closely at those roots, those three schools, the Frankfurt School, the Fabian School, and the Gramsci School, you will see everything that Alinsky uses is Marxist.
Yes.
All these cultural Marxist streams. And so, I don't want to, make people's eyes roll in their head. You know, so one of my friends says to me, he says, you talk about this Gramsci, Frankfurt School, and people's eyes roll in their heads. What are you talking about? Well, guys, we've got to learn from history. We've got to know where these ideas and these philosophies come from. And one of the principles that we really wanted, and Dad in particular, he was so good on this, because I don't even think I was with him when we were developing it, but he brought me on board, was to show those deep historical roots in the Marxist traditions, to connect him directly right back to Marx himself.
All right, we're going to run out of time here, so get the movie Wolf in Sheep's Clothing. Watch it 10 times. I've watched it twice so far. You will learn, you will be shocked, you'll be saddened, but you'll be educated, and many things will then start to explain themselves, and you'll start to say, oh, okay, now I'm starting to get it.
Yeah.
There's
hope for this. You know, the ending of the film is very hopeful, because
it is.
As Christians, we have to try to convert these people. We have to bring them to Christ,
right?
And hopefully it may not happen. It may not happen with many of these ideologues. I'm not convinced that. But in God's eyes, He can do it. That's why at the end of the film we tell the story of the Wolf of Gubbio and Saint Francis's attempt to try to stop this wild beast from eating the people of this town, and in the end he converts the wolf, and that's really, as Christians, that's what we want. That's why we made this film, was to try to convert people back to the gospel.
Now I have to say, just as a as an aside, when I'm watching the trailer, that awesome trailer that you made,
Thank you.
That does not scream EWTN. It screams Spike TV or something. It makes you want to watch it. You go like, oh, really? This is on EWTN? No way. No, it is. And it's a great job on the film, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Before you go, subject that I began in March of 2016, so I'm coming up on my three-year anniversary, my sad but tragic and true slogan, the demons are ascended. They come for the children. They won't take no for an answer.
Exactly.
It occurred to me, and I coined that phrase in March 2016. Unfortunately, it's still with us more so today than it was then. And your film is going to address this directly, the gender agenda.
This is the sequel to A Wolf in Sheep's Clothing.
The sequel. This is where Alinskyism ends, and ultimately the rejection of nature itself.
Exactly.
Yes, yes, right.
The roots of this, I mean, obviously there are other wolves that we can tell the story of, and the two that are the two villains that are profiled in this film are Simone de Beauvoir and Alfred Kinsey.
Oh, now, just briefly, I don't remember who wrote the book, but I have it in this 1,500-volume library that I have scattered around this building here. It was called The Kinsey Deception. It came out in 1991, 92. You probably know the book, Stephen.
Yep.
I read that book before the Sodomite Sacristan Revolution. I read that book, so when this started happening, I knew who the author of much of this was and how they were getting this, they were sliding this into the public sphere. Now, they don't use it anymore because they don't need it, but in the 90s, the 80s and 90s, they needed the sick, twisted, perverted work of Alfred Kinsey. And who was his henchman? Because it wasn't just Kinsey.
Well, it really comes out of the depths of socialism, the Fabian Society, the father of sex education is a forgotten source, but it's Havelock Ellis, who is the lover of Margaret Sanger, you know, and his buddy Magnus Hirschfeld. And they really created the sexology movement, which came to the United States, and its major progenitor here was Mary Calderon, who was the medical director of Planned Parenthood and moved over to found SECUS, the Sex Information and Education Council of the U.S.,
wow,
which really has shaped the sex education in public schools and now in Catholic schools, with the perversions of, sexual perversions of all kinds. And we have to remember that even going back, the first gay parade was in 1917, sponsored by the Bolsheviks of the revolution and held in Moscow. And the great figure that came, that developed the feminist movement out of cultural Marxist orientation, because it's Leninist rather than Stalinist. Stalin was against a lot of the homosexuality and so on later, but because we have to see that cultural Marxism is a Leninist orientation.
Sure.
Anyway, this begets people in the later in the Frankfurt School, like Herbert Marcuse and Wilhelm Reich, who shaped much of what happened in this country. And Antonio Gramsci says, "Well, let's do that over a long time. No brutal, bloody revolutions. Let's infiltrate, especially the church." Because he, as an Italian theist, he hated the church, and he, that's his major contribution, along with incrementalism.
So the Kinsey Deception, though, Stephen, quickly, and Richard, quickly, the Kinsey Deception. Well, folks, if you don't know this, what this pervert basically did was conduct these alleged studies in far too many instances using children and exposing them to various sexual activities. He did this to prove that homosexuality was natural, normal. Pederasty is natural, normal. His findings say they don't use them anymore because they've been so thoroughly discredited. It's bunk. It's junk. He said about 10%, 10 to 12% of the population at any given time was homosexual. He was only off by a factor of 2,000%. This guy has just been absolutely totally discredited, and people don't know about him today. And no one in the transgender revolution will use Kinsey's work because they know they can't. But it was used. You got to understand this. It was used. It was referred to. It was gospel until it was totally debunked. Am I right, Stephen?
So-called research. I mean, this is it's an outrage. If you look at Table 34 in his studies in his book, Table 34 shows how little children at the age of 6 years old were sexually abused for 24-hour periods.
Right,
and he's tracking so-called
You can't even use the word. It's impossible to describe.
I don't even want to use the word. Yeah, it's so shocking that we show it in the we don't show, but we tell the story of this, and people love their children. People want to Catholics and Christians want to protect their children, and this is the father of all of this. Okay, lifestyle
yes.
that is being propagated now today in all of our schools, definitely all of our public schools.
Oh, every single one of them.
Every single one of them. Even the Christian ones some of them have embraced a lot of this stuff, especially if they're taking the money from the federal government.
Now, when does the when do you think the film, the agenda, the gender agenda comes out?
Oh, sometime after Easter.
Okay, all right.
We hoped originally for Ash Wednesday, but, we're really trying to craft something, a classic here, so that it'll be used for years to come for people to really get a sense of these two new wolves, Kinsey as well as Du Bovoir as the king and queen of the disaster that we see today.
Well,
I have to know that basically the American Statistical Association rejected Kinsey's science, and also the Kinsey Institute refuses to make available those the original data and the basis for it.
Right, that's right.
So you can never make a decision on a science without having it verified, and there's no verification for it, and it's obvious from the changing data that that came from the Kinsey Institute over the years that it's just not there, and so we go into that very systematically in the film.
I can't wait to see this. So my special guests today have been Richard and Stephen Payne, and the sequel to The Wolf in Sheep's Clothing is The Gender Agenda, or if you're a New Orleanian, The Gender Agenda. So,
basically the code of criminal civil law that was issued as a result of Kinsey's findings, wiped out our natural law and the common law that was drawn from the Judeo-Christian morality in the 60s and 70s. And this was the American Law Institute did the code was funded by Rockefeller. And like Kinsey's work was funded by Rockefeller. And we have an amazing quote from Rockefeller admitting to this as part of the strategy of having he's speaking to the trilateral group that he was the head of and throwing out all kinds of well wishes to Life, Look, Time, and other mainstream media, television, for being quiet about what he was doing for 40 years. And this is a talk David Rockefeller gave in 1991. And he admitted that it was his plan was implemented for the purpose of a new world order,
Hugh Hefner committed himself as He swore that he would be Kinsey's pamphleteer, and he did in the end. He made sure of that.
Wow, I didn't.
Alexander Solzhenitsyn, he said, the eminent Russian author of the Gulag.
Such
as it is, however, the press has become the greatest power. These are his words. Power within Western countries, more powerful than the legislative power, the executive, and the judiciary. And one would then like to ask, what law has it been, by what law has it been elected, and to whom is it responsible?
You know what, I hold here in my hands, gentlemen, the latest edition to the St. Austin Review, edited by my colleague, contemporary, and dear friend, Joseph Pierce.
Guess what it is? Oh, good. Joseph's wonderful.
Guess what it is? Solzhenitsyn, 1918-2018, a centenary celebration.
That suffered under communism firsthand. He knows how to say it better than anybody.
I got to tell you, I am so glad that we got the chance to talk. Now, are you two going to this conflab in Fort Lauderdale or West Palm Beach?
Yes.
I'm going to go. Mm-hmm. Just to meet you two, I'm going to go now. So.
All right. Well, listen, that'll be fun. Hey, laugh,
forward to that.
Lots of laughter and good red wine, too.
I gotta tell you, how many of your films are available for me to resell or that you have on DVD?
We'll send you that list, sure.
I would love to be your spokesman, your representative, or do what I can to promote this work.
Yeah, sure.
But this work that you're talking about here today, gentlemen, Stephen and Richard Payne, we're all in your debt. Thank you for bringing this story out, because this is one of these stories that, you know, your mainstream press is not going to touch it. They have no interest in it. And if they did, it would be to glorify and to say, oh, what a great guy Alinsky was. He got us away from that silly, nasty behemoth, that overbearing Roman Catholic Church.
The political correctness has polarized our society.
People are
not able to tell the truth anymore, and that's scary stuff.
So
we were invited to two personal, private audiences with Pope John Paul the Second, Saint John Paul, and the highlight of our life. We were really inspired by him so much, and you mentioned the celebration of the bicentennial.
Sure.
You know, Cardinal then Karol Wojtyla was the main emissary from the church to that event, and spoke at the Eucharistic conference, which was held in tandem with it. And he said, we're now standing in the face of the greatest historical confrontation humanity has ever experienced. I don't think that the American society or the whole wide circle of the Christian community realizes this fully. We're now facing the final confrontation between the church and the anti-church.
That's
between
right.
The gospel and the anti-gospel, between Christ and the antichrist. The confrontation lies within the plans of divine providence. It's therefore in God's plan, and it must be a trial which the church must take up and face courageously.
Boy, Stephen, I'm jealous that he's your dad and not mine. I'm kidding.
I could rent them to you for a minute.
I will borrow him in the first week in February.
I wouldn't charge.
Hey, one final question.
Might be a relief.
And we would love to represent your films anyway and assist you in any way that we can here on the Crusade Channel.
Thank you.
One final question, because I have such a fondness and a spot in my heart for her, and I never got to meet her, Alice von Hildebrand.
Oh, she's my dear friend.
You got to sit down and interview her, Stephen.
We did. And she's in the new film as well. She's not doing very well, so I would ask the audience to please pray for this.
Well, she just turned 100, didn't she?
Yeah.
No,
she's
mid-90s.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mid-90s. But she's not well, and so I ask the audience to please pray for her. She's such a saintly and good woman.
Oh, my goodness, what a gem.
The wife of of
Dr. Dietrich von Hildebrand.
Yeah. And in the new film, just quick, a lineup of we've got Ryan Anderson. We've got really the best in this field.
Judith Reisman
mm-hmm. at Liberty University.
Wow.
Paul Kangor. Yeah.
You got Paul Kangor. Wow. Okay.
We've got Robert Riley. We've got Father Paul Sullins, Father and Dr. Paul Witz, who's an eminent psychiatrist. And so we really we were blessed with some of the best people for this new film to really validate and communicate, hopefully communicate the pitfalls of this second evolution.
Well, I can tell you, having seen part one, that you did a magnificent job. We all anxiously await part two. And when we get close to it coming out, of course, we will have you back on the show. We'll talk about part two. Okay. I look forward to meeting you next month in Palm Beach.
Yeah.
And, folks, Richard and Stephen Payne, Arcadia Films, get the film. And of course, as I said, we'll try to make the arrangements for the other films as well. The film is called Wolf in Sheep's Clothing. It comes with a second special feature disc. You're not going to regret this. Gentlemen, what an inspiration you have been to me today.
You're an inspiration to us, Mike.
Yes, we love you, Mike. Yeah. Thanks so much. It's really been a privilege.
It's been my privilege, my pleasure. See you in a month, my brothers.
Yeah, I look forward to it.